Snow Falling on Cedars, Disc 5.
Old Jurgensen came out of the gallery leaning hard on his cane. Alvin Hooks held the swinging door for him, and Old shuffled past with his cane in his right hand and his left at the small of his back. He shuffled half sidewise, an injured crab, making his way toward where Ed Soames stood proffering the Holy Bible. When Ole arrived, he bobbled his cane from hand to hand before settling on the expediency of hanging it from his wrist. The stroke he'd suffered in June caused his hands to tremble. He'd been out among his pickers, sorting berries in a bin, when the sensation that the earth was tilting under his feet grew on him out of a more general dizziness and nausea that had inhabited him all morning. Ole reared up and made a last desperate effort to shrug off what was happening, but the sky seemed to crowd around his head, the earth buckled, and he keeled over into a strawberry bin. There he lay, blinking up at the clouds until two Canadian Indian pickers pulled him out by the armpits. They took him up to his house in the tractor bucket and laid him on his porch like a corpse. Liesel shook him until he grunted at her and drooled, and in the face of this she began a hysterical interrogation into the nature of his symptoms. When it became apparent he didn't intend to answer, she stopped talking and kissed his forehead. Then she hurried in and called Dr. Whaley. Since then he had withered rapidly. His legs were stilts, his eyes leaked water, his beard ended in wisps at the third button of his vest. His skin appeared pink and chafed. He perched in the stand, both hands wrapped around the head of his cane now, a tremulous and gangling old man. "Mr. Jurgensen," Alvin Hooks began, "you were for many years a neighbor of the Heine family in Center Valley, is that correct, sir?"
"Yes,"
said old Jurgensen. "How many years?"
"Just always," said old. "Why, I can remember back 40 years to when Carl, old Carl, cleared his land next to mine."
40 years, said Alvin Hooks. "For 40 years you were a berry farmer?"
"Yes, sir, more than 40.
"How many acres did you own, Mr. Jurgensen?" Ole seemed to think about it. He licked his lips and squinted at the courthouse ceiling. His hands roamed up and down the length of his cane.
35 start out," he said. "Then I acquired 30 more from Etta, you see, like Etta tell before when she was up here. So that brought me up to 65 acre. Big farm it was."
"Yes," said Alvin Hooks. "So you purchased 30 acres from Etta Heine, then?"
"Yes, sir, I did so."
"And when was that, Mr. Jurgensen?"
"Just like she tell, 1944.
"She handed over to you the property deed at that time?"
"Yes, sir."
"In your mind, Mr. Jurgensen, did the deed read free and clear? That is, were there any encumbrances or conditions, easements, liens, that sort of thing?"
"No," said old Jurgensen. "No thing like that. The contract was good. Everything looked right with it."
"I see," said Alvin Hooks. "So you were not aware of any claim, then, that the Miyamotos might have had to any 7 of your newly purchased 30 acres?
"Not aware, no,"
said Ole.
"I bring it up with Etta, you see, because the Miyamoto family, they have a house on the property. I know 7 acres has been sold to them, but Etta says to me they don't make no payment, so she is to repossess. She don't have any choice after Carl passed away, says she. Everything looks good with the contract, says she. The Miyamoto family away in the camp, says she, maybe they won't come back. She is going to give them their money, says she. They don't have any claim, no, sir."
"So you heard nothing about any claim the Miyamotos might have had to 7 acres of your newly purchased land?"
"No, I hear nothing about it until that man," he aimed his nose at the defendant, "come round about and tell me."
"Do you mean the defendant there, Kabuo Miyamoto?"
"Him," said Ole. "Yes, that's right."
"He came around when, Mr. Jurgensen?"
"Let's see," said Ole. He come summer of 45, he does. He shows up at my place and say, Mrs. Heine robbed him. Mr. Heine never would have let no such thing like that happen, he says.
I'm not following, said Alvin Hooks. The defendant showed up at your farm in the summer of 1945 and accused Etta Heine of robbing him?
Yes, sir, that's what I remember.
And what did you say?
I say no to him. She sell the land to me, and I don't see his name any place on the contract.
Yes?
He wants to know, will I sell it back to him?
Sell it back? Said Alvin Hooks. The 30 acres?
He don't want all 30, answered Ole. He just want the 7 in the northwest where his family was one time living before the war.
And did you talk about that? Did you consider selling?
He didn't have no money, said Ole. Anyway, I'm not thinking of selling then. It was before my stroke. I had a good farm, 65 acres. I don't want to sell one piece to anybody.
Mr. Jurgensen, said Alvin Hooks, when you purchased Etta Heine's 30 acres, did you acquire her home as well?
No, she sold it separate. Just the house to Bjorn Andreasen, and he is still living there now.
And the house the defendant's family had lived in, Mr. Jurgensen?
This one, said Ole, I bought.
I see, said Alvin Hooks. And what did you do with it?
I use it for my pickers, you see, said Ole. My farm was so big now, I need to have a manager with me year-round, so he is living there, plus room for pickers come picking time.
Mr. Jurgensen, Alvin Hooks said, did the defendant say anything else to you during his visit in the summer of 1945? Anything you can remember? Old Jurgensen's right hand left the head of his cane. It clawed its way into the side pocket of his coat and fumbled about for something.
Yes, one thing, said Ole. He said someday he would get his land back.
That he would get it back?
Yes, sir. And he is angry.
And what did you say?
I said to him, why is he angry to me? I don't know anything about this land except that I don't want to sell it to nobody.
Ole lifted a handkerchief to his mouth and dried his lips with it.
I say to him, go talk with Etta Heine. She is moved into Amity Harbor. I tell him where he can look for her. She is the person to talk to.
And did he leave then?
Yes.
And did you see him again?
I see him, yes. This island is small. You live hereabouts, you see everybody.
All right, Alvin Hooks said. You've had a stroke, Mr. Jurgensen, as you say, and that was in June of this year?
Yes, sir, June 28th.
I see, said Alvin Hooks. And it incapacitated you so that you felt you could no longer run your farm? Old Jurgensen didn't answer at first. His right hand, with the handkerchief in it, returned to the head of his cane. He chewed on the inside of his cheek. His head shook. Ole struggled to speak.
Yes, he said. I just couldn't do it, you see.
You couldn't run your farm?
No.
So what did you do?
I put it on the market. For sale,
said Ole Jurgensen.
September 7th, just after Labor Day.
Of this year?
Yes, sir.
Did you list your property with a real estate agent, Mr. Jurgensen?
Yes, sir.
With Klaus Hartmann?
Yes, sir.
Did you advertise in any other way?
We had a sign on the barn, said Ole. That was everything.
And what happened then? Asked Alvin Hooks. Did anybody come to look?
Karl Heine came, said Ole. Karl Heine, Etta's son.
When was that? Alvin Hooks asked.
That was September 7th, said Ole. Round about comes Karl Heine, wanting to buy my farm.
Tell us about that, Alvin Hooks asked gently. Karl Heine was a successful fisherman. He owned a fine place on Mill Run Road. What did he want with your farm? Old Jurgensen blinked half a dozen times. He dabbed at his eyes with his handkerchief. The young man, he remembered, Carl Jr., had driven into his yard that morning in a sky-blue Bel Air, scattering chickens before him. Ole, from his place on the porch, knew who it was immediately. He guessed what it was he wanted. The young man had come by each picking season. He'd brought along his wife and children. They'd taken their caddies into the fields and picked berries together. Ole had always refused Carl's money, but Carl had pressed it on him. When Ole shook his head, Carl put the bills on the weighing table next to the scales beneath a stone. "Don't care if it was my father's land once," he'd say. "It's yours now. We'll pay." Now here he was, big like his father, with his father's stature and his mother's face, dressed like a fisherman in rubber boots. He was a fisherman, Ole recalled, had named his boat after his wife, the Susan Marie. Liesel had given the young man a glass of iced tea. He'd sat down so that from where they looked, the strawberry fields spread out before them. Way in the distance, they could just make out the broad side of Bjorn Andreasen's house, where Carl Jr. had once lived. Small talk, Ole explained now to the court. Carl had asked about the strawberries this year. Ole had asked about the salmon runs. Liesel had inquired as to Etta's health, and then she had asked Carl how the fishing life suited him. "It doesn't," Carl had answered. It had been, thought Ole, an odd thing for the young man to say aloud. It must have hurt his pride to say it. He'd been admitting something. Ole understood, and admitting it for a reason. He'd wanted to make a point. The young man had put his glass down just in front of his rubber boots and leaned toward them, his elbows on his knees, as if he was about to confess something. He'd looked at the floorboards of the porch for a moment. "I want to buy your farm," he'd said. Liesel had explained to him how Bjorn Andreasen had the old Heine house. There was nothing to be done about it. Liesel had explained that she and Ole didn't want to leave the farm at all, but there was nothing to be done about that either. And the young man had nodded and scratched the bristles along his jaw. "I'm sorry for that," he'd said quietly. "I feel bad to take advantage of your health, Mr. Jurgensen, but if you have to sell, I guess, well, I'm interested." Ole had said, "I am happy. You have lived here. You know this place. We do what is fair. I am happy." And he'd reached his hand toward the young man. The young man took it solemnly. "It's the way I feel, too," he'd said. They'd spoken in the kitchen of the arrangements they would make together. Carl's money was tied up in the Susan Marie and in his house on Mill Run Road. In the meantime, there was $1,000 in earnest money. Carl put it on the table. 10 $100 bills. Come November, the boat would sell, then the house, said Carl. "Your wife will be happy," said Liesel with a smile. "Fishermen are always gone at night." Old Jurgensen leaned on his cane and remembered another visitor later that same day. Kabuo Miyamoto had come to see him. "The defendant?" asked Alvin Hooks. "On September 7th of this year?"
"Yes, sir," said Ole.
"The same day Carl Heine came to see you to inquire about the sale of your land?"
"Yes, sir."
"In the afternoon of that same day?"
"Round about lunch," said Ole. "We were just about sitting down to lunch, it was. Miyamoto knocked on our door."
"And did he say, Mr. Jurgensen, what he wanted?"
"Same as Etta's son," said Ole. "He wanted to buy my land."
"Tell us about that," said Alvin Hooks. "What exactly did he say to you?" They'd sat down on the porch together, explained Ole. The defendant had seen the sign on the barn and wanted to buy Ole's farm. Ole had remembered the Japanese man's promise, how he'd stood in the fields and vowed that one day he would get his family's land back. The Japanese man had slipped his mind altogether. 9 years had passed. He'd remembered, too, that the Japanese man had worked for him years before, part of a crew that put in his raspberries in 1939. all remembered him pounding home cedar posts for raspberry canes, standing in the bed of a pickup truck, shirtless, swinging a maul. He must have been 16 or 17. He remembered seeing him early in the morning, too, swinging a wooden sword in the fields. The boy's father, he remembered, was Zinichi, something like that. He never could pronounce it. On the porch he'd asked Kabuo about his father, but the man had long passed away. The Japanese man had asked about the land then and asserted his wish to buy the 7 acres his family had once held. "I'm afraid it isn't for sale," Liesel had said. "It's already been sold, you see. Somebody else came by this morning, I'm sorry to tell you, Kabuo."
"Yes," said Ol, "we're sorry."
The Japanese man had stiffened. In a moment, the politeness went from his face so that Ol could no longer read him. "It's sold?" he said. "Already?"
"Yes," said Liesel. "Just like that. We're sorry to disappoint you."
"All of it?" asked the Japanese man.
"Yes," said Liesel. "We're very sorry. We didn't even have time to take our sign down."
The stiff expression of Kabuo Miyamoto's face didn't change even for a second.
"Who bought it?" he said. "I want to talk to them." "Etta Heine's son, Carl," said Liesel. "He came by around 10 o'clock.
"Carl Heine," the Japanese man answered, with a hint of anger in his voice. Ol had suggested that Kabuo Miyamoto go to see Carl Heine about the matter. Perhaps something could be worked out. Liesel shook her head and wrung her hands in her apron.
"We've sold it," she'd repeated apologetically. "Ol and Carl shook hands, you see. We accepted earnest money. We're bound to our agreement. It's sold, you see. We're sorry."
The Japanese man had stood then. "I should have come earlier," he said. The next day, Carl had come by again. Liesel phoned him about Kabuo Miyamoto to take the sign down from the barn. Ol, leaning on his cane, stood below and told him about the Japanese man's visit. Carl, he remembered, had been interested in the details of it. He nodded his head and listened closely. Old Jurgensen told everything, the way the politeness had gone out of the Japanese man, the unreadable Japanese expression on his face when he heard that the land he coveted had been sold. Carl Heine nodded again and again, and then came down from the ladder with the sign. "Thanks for telling me," he'd said. Chapter 11. After the noon recess was called that day, Kabuo Miyamoto ate lunch in his cell as he had 77 times. The cell was one of two in the courthouse basement and had neither bars nor windows. It was big enough for a low military surplus bunk, a toilet, a sink, and a nightstand. There was a drain in the corner of its concrete floor and a foot-square grate in its door. Other than this, there were no openings or apertures through which light could seep. A naked bulb hung overhead, and Kabuo could turn it on and off by screwing and unscrewing it in its socket. Yet before the first week was over, he discovered in himself a preference for darkness. His eyes adjusted to it. He was less troubled by the closeness of his cell walls, with the naked light put out, less conscious that he was jailed. Kabuo sat on the edge of his bunk with his lunch perched in front of him on the nightstand. A peanut butter and jelly sandwich, 2 carrot sticks, a mound of lime gelatin, a tin cup of milk, served on a cafeteria tray. At this particular moment, his light was on. He'd turned it on in order to see what he was eating, but also in order to look at his face in a handheld shaving mirror. His wife had said he looked like one of Tojo's soldiers. He wanted to see if this was so. He sat with his tray just in front of his knees, confronting his reflection in the hand mirror. He could see how his face had once been a boy's face, and how on top of this was laid the face of his war years. A face he was no longer surprised to see, though it had astonished him greatly in the beginning. He had come home from the war and seen in his own eyes the disturbed, empty reaches he'd seen in the eyes of other soldiers he'd known. They did not so much seem to stare right through things as to stare past the present state of the world into a world that was permanently in the distance for them, and at the same time more immediate than the present. Kabua remembered much in this manner. Under the surface of his daily life was a life he lived as if underwater. Kabua remembered how under the helmet of the soldier on the wooded hillside, underneath the steady droning of the bees, it had turned out to be a very young boy he had shot directly through the groin. When Kabua approached from one side, the boy had stared up at him and spoke through clenched teeth in tremulous German. Then the boy panicked and moved his hand toward his gun, and Kabuo shot him one more time in the heart at point-blank range. Yet still the boy refused to die and lay on his back between two trees while Kabuo stood 5 feet away, frozen, his rifle shouldered still. The boy held his chest in both of his hands and exerted himself to raise his head from the ground, at the same time gathering himself to take a breath and sucked in the hot afternoon air. Then he spoke again, between his teeth, and it was clear to Kabuo that he was begging, pleading, that he wanted the American who had killed him to save him. He had no choice but to ask him for this. Nobody else was present. All of it was too much, and when the boy stopped talking, his chest twitched a half dozen times, and blood ran from his mouth and down his cheeks. Then Kabuo went forward with his rifle and squatted beside the German boy on his right, and the boy put his hand on Kabuo's boot and shut his eyes and gave out. The tension stayed in his mouth for a while, and Kabuo watched until it faded. The smell of breakfast soon rose from the German boy's bowels. Kabuo sat in his prison cell now and examined his reflection carefully. It was not a thing he had control over. His face had been molded by his experiences as a soldier, and he appeared to the world seized up inside precisely because this was how he felt. It was possible for him all these years later to think of the German boy dying on the hillside, and to feel his own heart pound as it had as he squatted against the tree, drinking from his canteen, his ears ringing, his legs trembling. What could he say to people on San Pedro to explain the coldness he projected? The world was unreal, a nuisance that prevented him from focusing on his memory of that boy, on the flies in a cloud over his astonished face, the pool of blood filtering out of his shirt and into the forest floor, smelling rank, the sound of gunfire from the hillside to the east. He'd left there, and then he hadn't left. And still there had been more murders after this, 3 more, less difficult than the first had been, but murders nonetheless. So, how to explain his face to people? After a while, motionless in his cell, he began to feel objective about his face, and then he saw what Hatsue did. He had meant to project to the jurors his innocence. He'd wanted them to see that his spirit was haunted. He sat upright in the hope that his desperate composure might reflect the shape of his soul. This was what his father had taught him. The greater the composure, the more revealed one was. The truth of one's inner life was manifest, a pleasing paradox. It had seemed to Kabuo that his detachment from this world was somehow self-explanatory, that the judge, the jurors, and the people in the gallery would recognize the face of a war veteran who had forever sacrificed his tranquility in order that they might have theirs. Now, looking at himself, scrutinizing his face, he saw that he appeared defiant instead. He had refused to respond to anything that happened, had not allowed the jurors to read in his face the palpitations of his heart. Yet listening to Etta Heine on the witness stand had moved Kabuo to bitter anger. He had felt his carefully constructed exterior crumbling when she spoke to the court so insultingly about his father. The desire had come over him to deny what she said, to interrupt her testimony with the truth about his father, a strong and tireless man, honest to a fault, kind and humble as well. But all of this he suppressed. Now in his jail cell, he stared into the mirror at the mask he wore, which had been arranged by its wearer to suggest his war and the strength he'd mustered to face its consequences, but which instead communicated haughtiness, a cryptic superiority not only to the court, but to the prospect of death the court confronted him with. The face in the hand mirror was none other than the face he had worn since the war had caused him to look inward. And though he exerted himself to rearrange it, because this face was a burden to wear, it remained his, unalterable, finally. He knew himself privately to be guilty of murder, to have murdered men in the course of war, and it was this guilt, he knew no other word, that lived in him perpetually, and that he exerted himself not to communicate. Yet the exertion itself communicated guilt, and he could see no way to stop it. He could not change how his face arranged itself while he sat with his hands on the defendant's table with his back to his fellow islanders. In his face, he knew, was his fate, as Nels Gudmundsson had asserted at the start of things.
"There are facts," he'd said, "and the jurors listen to them, but even more, they watch you. They watch to see what happens to your face, how it changes when witnesses speak. For them, at bottom, the answer is in how you appear in the courtroom, what you look like, how you act."
He liked this man, Nels Gudmundsson. He had begun to like him on the September afternoon when he first appeared at his cell door, carrying a folded chessboard beneath his arm, and a Havana cigar box full of chess pieces. He'd offered Kabuo a cigar from his shirt pocket, lit his own, then brought two candy bars out of the box and dropped them on the bunk beside Kabuo without acknowledging that he had done so. It was his way of being charitable.
"I'm Nels Gudmundsson, your attorney," he said. "I've been appointed by the court to represent you. I
didn't do it," Kabuo had said. "I'm not guilty of anything."
"Look," said Nels, "I'll tell you what. We can worry about that later, all right? I've been trying to find someone with the free time to play chess for 50 years now, even more. Seems to me you just might be the fellow."
"I am," said Kabuo, "but..."
"You were in the service," said Nels. "My guess is you play a mean game of chess. Chess, checkers, rummy, bridge, hearts, dominoes, cribbage. And what about solitaire?" added Nels. "Solitaire might be the thing for you in here."
"Never liked solitaire," Kabuo answered. "Besides, a guy who starts playing solitaire in jail is just asking to get depressed."
"Never thought of that," said Nels. "We'll have to get you out of here. That's all there is to it."
He smiled. Kabuo nodded. "Can you?"
"They're not budging just now on anything, Kabuo. You're here until your trial, I think."
"There shouldn't even be a trial," said Kabuo.
"Alvin Hooks would disagree," said Nels. "He's putting his case together. He's serious about murder in the first degree, and he's serious about asking for the death penalty. We should be, too. We should get serious. We have a lot of work to do, you and I. But first, what about chess?"
"The death penalty," Kabuo said to himself. He was a Buddhist and believed in the laws of karma, so it made sense to him that he might pay for his war murders. Everything comes back to you. Nothing is accidental. The fear of death grew in him. He thought of Hatsue and of his children. and it seemed to him he must be exiled from them, because he felt for them so much love, in order to pay his debts to the dead he had left on the ground in Italy. "You sit on the bunk," he said to Nels, trying to calm himself. "We'll draw up the nightstand for the board."
"Fine," Nels said. "Just fine."
The old man's hands fumbled setting up the chess pieces. They were darkly spotted, and the skin, translucent in appearance, was prominently veined.
"White or black?"
Nels asked. "Advantages to both," replied Kabul. "You choose, Mr. Goodmanson."
"Most players prefer to open," Nels said. "Why is that, anyway?"
"Must see some advantage in going first," said Kabul. "Must believe in taking the offensive."
"And you don't?"
inquired Nels. Kabuo took up a pawn in each hand and put them behind his back. "Best way to settle the problem," he said. "This way, all you have to do is guess." He held his closed fists in front of Nels.
"Left,"
the old man said.
"If we're going to leave it to chance, left is as good as right. They're both the same this way."
"You don't prefer it?" said Kabuo. "You prefer white or black?"
"Open your hands,"
Nell answered, and tucked his cigar in between his teeth high up on the right side. Dentures, it occurred to Kabuo. As it turned out, the first move was Nell's. As it turned out, the old man never castled. He had no interest in an endgame. His strategy was to give up points for position, to give up men in the early going in return for an undefeatable board posture. He'd won, even though Kabuo could see what he was doing. There was no fiddling around. The game, quite suddenly, was over. Kabuo set the hand mirror on his tray of food now and ate half of the lime gelatin. He chewed down his carrot sticks and what remained of his sandwich, then poured out the tin cup of milk and filled it twice with water. He washed his hands, removed his shoes, and lay down on the jail bed. After a while, he stood up again and turned the light bulb in its socket. Then, in the darkness, the accused man lay down again, shut his eyes, and dreamed. He dreamed without sleeping, daydreams, waking dreams, as had come to him often in his jail cell. In this manner he escaped from its walls and roamed in freedom along San Pedro's wood paths, along the verges of its autumn pastures, crusted over with skins of hoarfrost. He followed in his mind certain remnants of trail that gave out suddenly in blackberry riots or in fields of unexpected Scotch broom. In his thoughts were vestiges of old skid roads and forgotten farm paths that bled into vales of ghost fern and hollows filled with skunk cabbage. Sometimes these trails faded at mud bluffs overlooking the sea. Other times they wandered down onto beaches where thick cedars, sapling alders and vine maples, toppled by winter tides, lay with the tips of their desiccated branches buried in sand and gravel. The waves brought seaweed in and draped it across the downed trees in thick, oozing skeins. Then his mind moved outward, and Kabuo was at sea again, his net set, the salmon running, and he was standing on the foredeck of the islander with the breeze in his face, the phosphorus in the water brilliant before him, the white caps silver in the moonlight. From his bunk in the island county jail, he felt the sea again and the swells under his boat as it rode over the foam. With his eyes shut, he smelled cold salt and the odor of salmon in the hold, heard the net winch working and the deep note of the engine. Rafts of seabirds rose off the water, making way in the first misty light with the islander bound for home on a cool morning. Half a thousand kings in her hold, the whine of wind in her rigging. At the cannery, he held each fish in his hands before tossing it up and over the side. Lambent chinooks, lithe and sleek, as long as his arm and weighing a fourth what he did, slick, glassy eyes held open. He could feel them in his hands again, while overhead the gulls flew tangents. When he put off and motored for the docks, the gulls followed on high with their breasts opened to the wind. Then he was amid a flock of gulls while he swabbed the deck of the Islander. He heard their squawking and watched them circle low, angling for scraps, while Marlon Tenniscold or William Joe Vogg shot at them with a side-by-side so that the gulls settled out on the water. The gun's report echoed from the hills of Amity Harbor. And then Kabuo remembered what he had missed this year. The birch and alder going golden and red. The rust autumn hue of the vine maples. The russet colors of early October. The cider press, pumpkins, and baskets of young zucchini squash. The smell of dying leaves in the motionless gray morning as he shambled up onto the porch after a night's fishing. And the full fine growth in the cedar trees. The scritching sound of leaves underfoot, leaves mashed into paste after rains. He'd missed fall rains. The water dripping along the knobs of his spine and mixing with the sea spray in his hair. Things he hadn't known he'd miss. In August, he'd taken his family to Lanhedrin Island. They'd tied off to a float, and he'd rowed them up onto Sugar Sand Beach in the skiff. His daughters stood in the surf and poked at jellyfish with sticks and collected sand dollars. Then they followed the beach creek up through a dell, Kabuo carrying the baby on his right arm, until they came to a waterfall, a cascade tumbling from a wall of moss. They ate their lunch there in the shadows of the hemlocks and gathered salmon berries. Hatsue found under birch trees a half-dozen destroying angels and pointed them out to her daughters. They were pure white and lovely, she explained, but fatal to eat. She pointed out, too, the maidenhair fern nearby. The black stems, she said, retained their shine in a pine needle basket's weave. He'd admired her fully on that day. She collected the stems of wild ginger for seasoning rice and yarrow leaves for tea. On the beach, she dug butter clams with a pointed stick, raking an arc in front of her. She found sea glass and a fossilized crab leg embedded in a concretion. She doused the baby with seawater. The girls helped Kabuo gather beech wood for a fire when evening came up. At the last of dusk, they launched their skiff again. His oldest daughter hooked a true cod in the kelp beds off Lanhedrin. He filleted it on the deck while Hatsue caught another on a hand line. They ate at sea, the cod, the clams, ginger rice, yarrow tea. His middle daughter and the baby slept on his bunk. His oldest daughter manned the wheel. Kabuo and Hatsue went forward. He stood with his chest against her back, and his hands in the rigging, until the lights of Amity Harbor came up to the south, and then he went in and repositioned the Islander in order to take the channel head-on. His daughter leaned against him after he took the wheel from her, and he came into the harbor that way at midnight, the girl's head against his arm. Then he remembered strawberry fields from before Manzanar, and he was in them as he'd always been, a sea of strawberries, rows and rows, a labyrinth of runners as intricate as a network of arteries feeding on the surface of a dozen farms he knew from childhood. He was in these mounded rows, stooped and picking with the sun on his neck, low against the land in a sea of green and red with the smell of the earth and its berries rising like a mist, filling by the labor of his hands the 12 woven pine baskets in his caddy. He saw his wife before she'd married him. He saw her picking at Ichikawa's farm, how he'd come toward her carrying his caddy, and as if by accident, by happenstance, how she hadn't seen him coming, intent on her work, bent to it, but at the last minute lifted her gaze, lissome as ever, continuously picking. Berries lay gently like red gems between her fingers, and while she met his eyes, fed one of her woven pine baskets, three of which already lay full on the caddy, mounded over with ripened fruit. He'd squatted down across from her and, picking, took her in, how she squatted with her chin near her kneecaps, her hair woven tautly into a long, thick rope, the sweat against her forehead, and the tendrils of hair that had escaped from their arrangement, loose strands fell across her cheeks and nose. She was 16. Low to the ground, folded together with her breasts against her thighs, she wore woven sandals and a red muslin summer dress, its narrow straps running over her shoulders. He saw again the strength of her legs, the brown of her ankles and calves, the suppleness of her spine, the film of sweat at her throat. Then it was evening, and he'd left the South Beach wood path to look at her home of worn cedar slats and across the fields to where she lived. Fields circumscribed by tall cedar trees and lit by spindly moonlight. A kerosene lantern flickered orange in the window of Hatsue's home. Her door stood open, ajar 10 inches, and an angle of lantern light spilled across her porch. Crickets and night toads, the brattle of a dog, laundry billowing on a line against the night breeze. And again he breathed in the green in the strawberry runners, the rain in the cedar duff and the salt water. She padded toward him with a bucket full of kitchen scraps, her sandals squeaking, moving toward the compost heap. And on her return trip, she'd passed between the rows of raspberries. He watched while she held her hair back with one hand, the other moving in search of the sweetest fruit, grazing among the canes. Her heels lifted from the sandals now and then. She slid the berries in between her lips, still holding her hair, the canes rebounding in quiet arcs when she freed the berry caps from their cores. He stood watching and imagined that if he kissed her that night, the taste of the raspberries would be cool in his mouth. He saw her just as he had seen her in history class, a pencil between her teeth, one hand laid against the nape of her neck, lost behind her effusive hair. She walked through the halls with her books pressed against her breasts, in pleated skirt, argyle sweater, white bobby socks folded down crisply above the polished onyx buckles of her shoes. She looked at him, and then away again quickly, saying nothing when he passed by. He remembered Manzanar, the dust in the barracks, in the tar-papered shacks and cafeteria, even the bread tasted gritty. They'd worked tending eggplants and lettuces in the camp garden. They'd been paid little, the hours were long. They'd been told it was their duty to work hard. He and Hatsue spoke of little things at first, then of the San Pedro fields they'd left behind and the smell of ripening strawberries. He had begun to love her, to love more than just her beauty and grace. And when he saw that in their hearts they shared the same dream, he felt a great certainty about her. They kissed in the back of a crew truck coming into camp one night, and the warm, wet taste of her, however brief, brought her down for him from the world of angels and into the world of human beings. In this way his love deepened. Working in the gardens, he would pass her by and, for a moment, slide one hand around her waist. She would squeeze his hand between her fingers, which had grown more calloused and hard at Manzanar, and he would squeeze back, and they would return to their weeding. The wind blew desert dust in their faces and dried their skin and turned their hair to wire. He remembered the expression on Hatsue's face when he told her he had enlisted. It was not the being gone, she said, though the being gone was a horrible thing. It was more that he might not ever return, or that he might return not himself. Kabuo had not made promises to her. He could not say if he was coming back or if he would come back the same man. There was this matter of honor, he'd explained to her, and he had no choice but to accept the duty the war imposed on him. At first she had refused to understand this and had insisted that duty was less important than love, and she hoped Kabuo felt the same way. But he could not bring himself to agree with this. Love went deep and meant life itself, but honor could not be turned from. He was not who he was if he didn't go to war, and would not be worthy of her. She turned from him and tried to stay away, and for 3 days they didn't speak. At last he'd come to her at dusk in the gardens and said that he loved her more than anything in the world and that he hoped only that she would understand why it was he had to leave. He asked for nothing else from her, only this acknowledgement of who he was, how his soul was shaped. Hatsue stood with her long-handled hoe and said that she had learned from Mrs. Shigemura that character was always destiny. He would have to do what he must do, and she would have to do the same. He'd nodded and exerted himself to show nothing. Then he turned and walked between the rows of eggplants. He was 20 yards off when she called his name and asked if he would marry her before leaving. "Why do you want to marry me?" he asked. And her answer came back, "To hold a part of you." She dropped the hoe and walked the 20 yards to hold him in her arms. "It's my character, too," she whispered. "It's my destiny now to love you." It had been, he saw now, a war marriage, hurried into because there was no choice, and because both of them felt the rightness of it. They had not known each other more than a few months, though he had always admired her from a distance. And it seemed to him, when he thought about it, that their marriage had been meant to happen. His parents approved, and hers approved, and he was happy to leave for the war in the knowledge that she was waiting for him and would be there when he returned. And then he had returned, a murderer. And her fear that he would no longer be himself was realized. He remembered, too, his father's face, and the sword his father kept inside a wooden chest in the days before Pearl Harbor. A katana made by the swordsmith Masamune. It had been in the Miyamoto family, it was said, for 6 centuries. His father kept it sheathed and rolled in cloth, an undecorated and highly useful weapon. Its beauty lay in its simplicity, the plainness of its curve. Even its wooden scabbard was spare and plain. His father had taken it, along with other things, his wooden kendo practice swords, his sageo, his obi, his hakama pants, his boken, and buried them one night in a strawberry field, laid them carefully wrapped in a hole along with the dynamite he'd used to clear stumps, a case full of books and scrolls written in Japanese, and a photograph taken of Kabuo at the San Pedro Japanese Community Center, dressed in the feudal costume of a bugeisha and wielding a kendo stick. Kabuo's training at kendo had begun when he was 7. His father had taken him one Saturday to the community center hall, where a dojo had been established in a corner of the gym. They knelt before an alcove at the back of the room and contemplated a shelf on which small bowls of uncooked rice had been neatly arranged. Kabuo learned to bow from a seated position. While he sat on his heels, his father explained softly the meaning of zenshin, which the boy understood to mean a constant awareness of potential danger. His father finished by repeating the word twice, "Zenshin! Zenshin!" Then took down a wooden pole from the wall and, before Kabuo knew what had happened, slammed him with it in the solar plexus. "Zenshin!" said Zenichi, while the boy caught his breath. "Didn't you say you understood?" His father said that if he was to learn kendo, more would be expected of him than of the average person. Did he wish to learn anyway? The choice was his. He should take some time to consider it. When Kabuo was 8, his father put a weapon in his hands for the first time, a boken. They stood in the strawberry fields early one July morning, just after picking season was finished. The Buchan, a curved piece of cherry wood 3 feet long, had been Kabuo's great-grandfather's, a man who had been a samurai before the Meiji Restoration, and later, after the wearing of swords was outlawed, a farmer of government rice lands on Kyushu for 10 days before he joined 200 other rebellious samurai in Kumamoto. They formed themselves into the League of the Divine Tempest and attacked an imperial garrison with swords aloft, having fasted for 3 days. Its defenders, wielding rifles, killed all but 29 with their opening volley. The survivors committed suicide on the battlefield, including Kabuo's great-grandfather. "You come from a family of samurai," Kabuo's father said to him in Japanese. "Your great-grandfather died because he could not stop being one. It was his bad fortune to live at a time when the samurai were no longer necessary. He could not adapt to this, and his anger at the world overwhelmed him. I remember what an angry man he was, Kabuo. He lived for revenge against the Meiji. When they told him he could no longer wear his sword in public, he conspired to kill men he hardly knew, government officials, men with families who lived near us, who were kind to us, whose children we played with. He became irrational in his behavior and spoke of purifying himself in such a manner that he would afterward be invulnerable to the Meiji rifles. He was always gone at night. We didn't know where he went. My grandmother bit her nails. She argued with him when he came home in the mornings, but he wouldn't change his ways or explain. His eyes were red, his face rigid. He sat eating from his bowl in silence, wearing his sword in the house. It was said that he had joined other samurai who had been displaced by the Meiji. They roamed the roads disguised, swords in hand, killing government officials. They were bandits, thieves, and renegades. My grandfather, I remember this, was happy to hear of Okubo Toshimichi's assassination, the man who had been responsible for the confiscation of his master's castle and the destruction of his master's army. He smiled, showed his teeth, and drank. My grandfather was an expert swordsman, Zenichi had explained, but his anger overwhelmed him in the end. It is ironic, because how often did he tell me when I was your age and he was a contented and peaceful man of the kind of sword a man should wield? The sword that gives life, not the sword that takes life, is the goal of the samurai, my grandfather said then. The goal of the sword is to give life, not to take it. You can be very good with the Buchan if you concentrate, said Kabuo's father. You have it in you. You have only to decide to learn now, when you are 8. I want to, replied Kabuo. I know you do, his father said. But look, your hands. Kabuo adjusted them. Your feet, said his father. The front turned in more. Too much weight on the back. They began to work on the vertical stroke, moving along between the strawberries, the boy advancing, the man retreating, the two of them together in it. The Buchan strikes, Kabuo's father said. The hips and stomach cut. You must tighten the stomach muscles as the stroke advances. No, you're locking your knees. They must give when you strike. Elbow soft, too, or there is no follow-through. The Buchan is cut off from the power of the body. Hips sink, knees and elbows go soft, stomach is hard. Cut, turn, again, strike. Kabuo's father showed him how to hold the wooden sword so that the wrists were flexible and liberated. An hour went by, and then it was time for field work, and they put the Buchan away. Thereafter, each morning, Kabuo practiced his kendo strokes. The vertical slash that would split a man's head down the bridge of the nose, leaving one eye on each side, the skull cleaved into two parts. The 4 diagonal strokes, from left and right, upward and downward, that would cleave a man beneath a rib or disjoin an arm deftly. The horizontal stroke, swinging in from the left, that could sever a man just above the hips. And finally, the most common of kendo strokes, a horizontal thrust a right-handed man could propel with great force against the left side, of his enemy's head. He practiced these until they were natural to him, part of who he was, the boken an extension of his hands. By the time he was 16, there was no one any longer at the community center who could defeat him, not even the half-dozen grown men on the island for whom kendo was a serious hobby, not even his father, who acknowledged his son's triumph without shame. It was said by many in the kendo club that Zenhichi, despite his years, remained the superior practitioner, the more pure between father and son, but that the boy, Kabuo, had the stronger fighting spirit and a greater willingness to draw on his dark side in order to achieve a final victory. It was only after he'd killed four Germans that Kabuo saw how right they were, how they had seen deeply into his heart with the clarity of older people. He was a warrior, and this dark ferocity had been passed down in the blood of the Miyamoto family, and he himself was fated to carry it into the next generation. The story of his great-grandfather, the samurai madman, was his own story too, he saw now. Sometimes, when he felt his anger rising because he had lost his family strawberry land, he gathered it up into the pit of his gut and stood in the yard with his kendo stick rehearsing the black choreography of his art. He saw only darkness after the war, in the world and in his own soul, everywhere but in the smell of strawberries, in the good scent of his wife and of his three children, a boy and two girls, three gifts. He felt he did not deserve, for a moment, the happiness his family brought to him, so that late at night, when he couldn't sleep, he imagined that he would write them a note explicating his sin completely. He would leave them and go to suffer alone, and his unhappiness would overwhelm his anger. The violence might at last die out of him and set him free to contemplate his destiny and his next life on the great wheel. Sitting where he sat now, accused of the murder of Karl Heiner, it seemed to him he'd found the suffering place he'd fantasized and desired. For Kabuo Miyamoto was suffering in his cell from the fear of his imminent judgment. Perhaps it was now his fate to pay for the lives he had taken in anger. Such was the nature of cause and effect. Such was the impermanence of all things. What a mystery life was. Everything was conjoined by mystery and fate. And in his darkened cell, he meditated on this, and it became increasingly clear to him. Impermanence, cause and effect, suffering, desire, the precious nature of life. Every sentient being straining and pushing at the shell of identity and distinctness. He had the time and the clarity about suffering to embark on the upward path of liberation, which would take him many lives to follow. He would have to gain as much ground as possible and accept that the mountain of his violent sins was too large to climb in this lifetime. He would still be climbing it in the next and the next, and his suffering inevitably would multiply. Chapter 12. Outside, the wind blew steadily from the north, driving snow against the courthouse. By noon, 3 inches had settled on the town, a snow so ethereal it could hardly be said to have settled at all. Instead, it swirled like some icy fog, like the breath of ghosts, up and down Amity Harbor streets. Powdery dust devils, frosted puffs of ivory cloud, spiraling tendrils of white smoke. By noon, the smell of the sea was eviscerated, the sight of it mistily depleted, too. One's field of vision narrowed in close, went blurry and snowbound, fuzzy and opaque. The sharp scent of frost burned in the nostrils of those who ventured out of doors. The snow flew up from their rubber boots as they struggled, heads down, toward Peterson's grocery. When they looked out into the whiteness of the world, the wind flung it sharply at their narrowed eyes and foreshortened their view of everything. Ishmael Chambers was out walking aimlessly in the snow, admiring it and remembering. The trial of Kabuo Miyamoto had brought that past world back for him. Inside their cedar tree for nearly 4 years, he and Hatsue had held one another with the dreamy contentedness of young lovers. With their coats spread against a cushion of moss, they'd stayed as long as they could after dusk and on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. The tree produced a cedar perfume that permeated their skin and clothes. They would enter, breathe deeply, then lie down and touch each other. The heat of it and the cedar smell, the privacy and the rain outside, the slippery softness of their lips and tongues inspired in them the temporary illusion that the rest of the world had disappeared. There was nobody and nothing but the two of them. Ishmael pressed himself against Hatsue while they held each other, and Hatsue pressed back, her hips leaving the moss, her legs open beneath her skirt. He felt her breasts and grazed the waistband of her underwear, and she stroked his belly and chest and back. Sometimes, when he was walking home through the forest, Ishmael would stop in some lonely place and, because he had no choice in the matter, take himself in his hand. He would think about Hatsue while he touched himself. He would shut his eyes and lean his head against a tree. Afterward, he felt better and worse. Sometimes at night he would squeeze his eyes shut and imagine how it might be to marry her. It didn't seem so far-fetched to him that they might move to some other place in the world where this would be possible. He liked to think about being with Hatsue in some place like Switzerland or Italy or France. He gave his whole soul to love. He allowed himself to believe that his feelings for Hatsue had been somehow preordained. He had been meant to meet her on the beach as a child, and then to pass his life with her. There was no other way it could be. Inside their cedar tree, they spoke of everything in the intense and overwrought manner of teenagers, and he found that she had many moods. There were times when she went cold and silent, and he felt her distance from him so completely that it seemed impossible to reach her. Even when he held her, it seemed to him there was a place in her heart he couldn't get to. At times he worked himself up to discussing this, gradually revealing to her how it hurt him to feel there was a part of her love she withheld. Hatsue denied that this was so, and explained to him that her emotional reserve was something she couldn't help. She had been carefully trained by her upbringing, she said, to avoid effusive displays of feeling, but this did not mean her heart was shallow. Her silence, she said, would express something if he would learn to listen to it. Yet his suspicion that he loved more deeply than she did nevertheless remained with him, and he worried about it perpetually. Hatsue, he found, had a religious side he had only sensed when they'd been younger. He drew her out in conversation on this matter, and she told him how she'd tried to keep in mind certain basic articles of her faith. All of life was impermanent, for example, a thing she thought about every day. It was important for a person to act carefully, for every action, Hatsue explained, had consequences for the soul's future. She confessed to experiencing a moral anguish over meeting him so secretly and deceiving her mother and father. It seemed to her certain that she would suffer from the consequences of it, that no one could maintain such deceit for so long without paying for it somehow. Ishmael argued at length about this, asserting that God could not possibly view their love as something wrong or evil. God, replied Hatsue, was personal. Only she could know what God wanted from her. Motive, she added, was very important. What was her motive in concealing from her parents the time she spent with Ishmael? This was the question that worried her most, determining for herself her motive. Ishmael at school feigned detachment in her presence and ignored her in the casual way she gradually taught him to use. Hatsue was a master of the art of false preoccupation. She would pass him in the hallway in her plaid blouse with its neat tucks, puffed sleeves and ruffled collar, with a bow in her hair, pleats in her skirt, and books hiked up against her breast, and move on with an apparently artless indifference that, in the beginning, painfully astonished him. How was it possible for her to feign such coldness without feeling it at the same time? By degrees, he learned to enjoy these encounters. Though his indifference always appeared more studied than hers, and he was always anxious, in a barely concealed way, to meet her gaze. He even said hello to her now and again as one element in his pretense. "Hard test," he'd say at the end of a class. "How'd you do, anyway?" "I don't know. I didn't study enough." "Did you do the essay for Sparling?" "I tried. It's about a page long. Mine, too, a little longer." He would move on, collect his books, and leave the room with Sheridan Knowles or Don Hoyt or Denny Horback. At the Strawberry Festival in 1941, he'd watched while the mayor of Amity Harbor had crowned Hatsue Strawberry Princess. The mayor had placed a tiara on her head and hung a sash over her left shoulder. Hatsue and four other girls made a promenade through the crowd and tossed strawberry-flavored candy to the children. Ishmael's father, owner, publisher, editor, chief reporter, photographer, and printer of the San Pedro Review, had a special interest in these proceedings. Year after year, they provided a lead story, complete with a portrait of the crowned and comely maiden, candids of picnicking families. "The Maltons of Protection Point enjoy Saturday's Strawberry Festival," and a beneficent editorial or boilerplate column approving the efforts of local organizers. "Ed Bailey, Lois Dunkirk, and Carl Heine Sr., without whom none of this would have been possible." Arthur wandered the picnic grounds in bow tie and suspenders, a pork pie hat pulled low over his forehead, and the enormous weight of his camera slung from a thick leather thong around his neck. Ishmael stood beside him while he photographed Hatsue. He winked at her when his father put one eye to the camera, and she gave back the faint trace of a smile. "Neighbor girl," his father said. "South Beach ought to be proud." He followed his father that afternoon, and they joined in the tug-of-war and the three-legged race. The strawberry floats, festooned with staghorn ferns, zinnias, and forget-me-nots, and with the royal court of the strawberry festival draped theatrically under cherry sprays and spruce boughs trained to wire guy lines, passed like ships before the somber eyes of the Strawberry Festival Association, which included the mayor, the chairman of the Chamber of Commerce, the fire chief, and Arthur Chambers. Again Ishmael stood beside his father, while Hatsue, on board her float, passed by, waving to everybody majestically with her crepe paper scepter in hand. Ishmael waved back and laughed. September came. They were high school seniors. A gray-green stillness settled into things, and the summer people left for their city homes again, soft overcast, night fog, low mists in the dips between hills, road mud, vacant beaches, empty clamshells scattered among rocks, silent shops folded in on themselves. By October, San Pedro had slipped off its summer reveler's mask to reveal a torpid, soporific dreamer whose winter bed was made of wet green moss. Cars slumped along the mud and gravel roads at 20 or 30 miles an hour like sluggish beetles beneath the overhanging trees. The Seattle people passed into memory and winter savings accounts. Stoves were stoked, fires banked, books taken down, quilts mended. the gutters filled with rust-colored pine needles, and the pungent effluvium of alder leaves, and the drain pipes splashed with winter rain. Hatsue told him one fall afternoon about her tutelage under Mrs. Shigemura, and the directive she'd been given as a girl of 13 to marry a boy of her own kind, a Japanese boy from a good family. She repeated that it made her unhappy to deceive the world. Her secret life, which she carried with her in the presence of her parents and sisters at every moment, made her feel she had betrayed them in a way that was nothing less than evil. There was no other word for it, she told Ishmael. Outside, the rain dripped from the canopy of cedar boughs down into the undergrowth of ivy. Hatsue sat with her cheek against her knees, looking out through the opening in the cedar tree, her hair a single braid down her spine. "It isn't evil," Ishmael insisted. "How can this be evil? It wouldn't make any sense for this to be evil. It's the world that's evil, Hatsue," he added. "Don't pay it any mind." "That isn't so easy," said Hatsue. "I lie every day to my family, Ishmael. Sometimes I think I'll go crazy with it. Sometimes I think this can't go on." Later they lay side by side against the moss, looking up into the darkened cedar wood with their hands folded behind their heads. "This can't go on," whispered Hatsue. "Don't you worry about that?" "I know," answered Ishmael. "You're right. What'll we do? What's the answer?" "I don't know," said Ishmael. "There isn't one, it looks like." "I heard a rumor," Hatsue replied. "There's a fisherman who claims to have seen a German submarine just off Amity Harbor. A periscope. He followed it for half a mile. Do you think that can be true?"
"No," said Ishmael. "It isn't true. People will believe anything. They're scared, I guess. It's just fear is all. They're afraid."
"I'm afraid, too," said Hatsue. "Everybody's afraid right now."
"I'm going to be drafted," answered Ishmael. "It's something I just have to face." They sat in their cedar tree, thinking about this. But the war still seemed far away. The war did not disturb them there, and they continued to view themselves as exceedingly fortunate in the particulars of their secret existence. Their absorption in one another, the heat of their bodies, their mingling smells and the movements of their limbs, these things shielded them from certain truths. Yet sometimes at night, Ishmael Chambers would lie awake because there was a war on in the world. He would turn his thoughts toward Hatsue then, and keep them there, until at the verge of sleep the war swam back to spill forth horribly anyway in his dreams.
This ends Disc 5.